The name of the new book is The Mouth That Roared, My Six Outspoken Decades in Baseball. It is published by Triumph. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dallas Green to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate that, too.
It's very nice to have you here. At what point did you decide you wanted to tell your story and share the stories that you tell in the book?
Well, really, it took some time because I another baseball book. I couldn't visualize it being in, being out there. But Alan Maimon, the writer that helped me out, he was a Phillies fan, and he pestered me, and my wife finally got involved with the act, and she finally said, it'd be great to tell your own kids and tell our grandkids what kind of life we led. And that was the beginning of it.
Growing up in Philadelphia during the 1970s and 1980s, so you were your god because you brought a world championship to the city of brotherly love in 1980. And that was like no feeling I've ever experienced in my life. It was fascinating to read in the book of what it meant to you and your realization of what it meant to the city and to the fans. What is that experience like for someone who has been in the game for as long as you've been in it?
Well, as an athlete, I mean, that's really what it's all about. I mean, if you talk to any of these guys, even these guys today that are making $20 million, they all point to the finger and they want that ring on their finger. And we had a group of guys that had played very well and grown up together in 76, 77, 78, had won a National League championship, but they didn't win they didn't get to the World Series. So it was kind of the last hurrah for them. And I had been a Philly all my life. Mr. Carpenter, who owned the Phillies, actually signed me to my first contract as a pitcher, and I got to be director of minor leagues and scouting after my playing days were over, and one thing led to another. The next thing I know, I'm out on the field trying to get the 1980 group together and win a championship. And it was just, we had a rough go for 162 games. We didn't win it until the 161st game of the year. And then we had a mind-blowing contest with the Houston Astros in a five-game playoff series. And we were as prepared, I think, to play the World Series as any team I've ever been around. And we did win it. And as a result of that, so much emotion came out. The first time ever that we had won a world championship for the team that I had grown up with and been a very big part of forever and ever. So the city and was special because they were a great sports town, but the championships were few and far between, and this was one special for the fans.
You grew up in Delaware, as you say. You were a Philly for most of your life, and whether you were a player or a manager or an executive, and certainly bounced around, you always came back to the Phillies, and you are currently a senior advisor to the general manager of the Phillies. Is it baseball as baseball, and teams are teams, or is there something about Philadelphia and Chicago and Boston and New York that is inherent to those teams and those cities?
Well, obviously the cities that you mentioned are so very, very competitive in all sports. They all have football, they all have basketball, and they all have hockey probably, and they have baseball teams. So the competition is unbelievable for the fan and for the city. I had just been so much a part of Philadelphia, even though I didn't live in Philadelphia, I still was so much part of Philadelphia that I just felt it was part of the family.
When you think of what it takes to be a manager, I mean, the title of the book is The Mouth That Roared. Much, of course, is made of your encounters with the press and players and agents and unions. But is that what it takes to be a good manager?
Well, I think every manager has to do things that work for his team. You know, I had been part of watching that team, as I said, for years and years. I knew the players, the main players, and I knew all the minor league kids that were coming up. So I knew pretty much what was going on in the organization. And whether you decide to rip and roar, which I did, because I told them right from the very beginning, I didn't want any more out of them than what they said they wanted to do, and that was win a world championship. And I told them right from the beginning that I had a game plan, Paul Owens and I had a game plan that we thought would get the job done. They had their chance, 76, 77, 78. Now it was our turn to do that, and I told them I wasn't going to let them up. I wasn't going to let them quit. I wasn't going to let them get away from the game plan, which was play good game situation baseball and play good team baseball and go out there and try to win every single day.
And then, you know, coaching in New York for both the Mets and the Yankees, I can't imagine more of a fishbowl situation.
Well, yeah, it's there's no question. New York's a different city. You got both teams there fighting for the back page of the newspapers and all the accolades and what happens, and it's really a dogfight between the Yankees and the Mets for the attention of the fan and attention of the city. I wanted to do the Yankee thing because I felt it was just steeped in history, you know, with the Yankee uniform and the Yankee mystique and the great stadium that we were going to play in. And I just was thrilled when I had that opportunity. Didn't last very long, but I thought we left it the best we could, based on the kind of team we had at that time. And the Mets were kind of the same way. We had a lot of adversity when I first went in there, and it took me a long time to clean it up and get the guys to recognize that they had to play some baseball.
How patient does a manager have to be? How patient does, and even an owner, how patient does George Steinbrenner have to be? How patient do they have to be of you as a coach and a manager of getting that team to where you want it?
Well, I think it goes back again to the you know, the history of that team, and the patience wasn't something that I was strong on when I took over the Phillies, for the simple reason that we had patience with that team, and that hadn't worked. And we were getting long in the tooth, and the guys were going to disappear here pretty soon. And we thought this might be the last hurrah. So that's the reason I banged them pretty good. You know, it's the same thing when you go to any other team. You have to make a judgment on what your team is capable of doing, really, and what is real. And the Yankee team was a bad baseball team. There's no question about that. And yet George Steinbrenner loved the Yankees, loved the New York City, and wanted to win desperately for that group, but it was a down time for the Yankees, and it just I keep saying the manager has to make his own bed and lie in it, because he's got to decide how best to handle the players that he's given.
And given that the 1980 you won a world championship, do you feel that is when you did some of your finest work as a manager?
Well, obviously, because you win, but and I have a World Series ring as a result of it. But
but you had a great team.
I never thought I was going to be a major league manager, for the simple reason that I was training myself, really, and Paul Owens was helping me train me for the general manager's job when he was going to retire. So this just came as an opportunity that I just couldn't turn down because of my association with the Phillies. So I struck lightning in a bottle, and I was as a result of that, it was kind of the springboard of my career.
One of the things that is so touching in the book, of course, is you write about the loss of your granddaughter, who was shot and killed in Tucson, Arizona, during the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords. And many of us, it came out as that story started to unfold, that we realized that you were part of it, that your family had been touched by that unspeakable tragedy. What was it like to then, I mean, once again, be thrust into a spotlight, but also to hear from a game and from a league that you had been such a part of how they rallied around you, because no matter who you ostracize in the process of playing baseball, something like that really puts it into perspective, doesn't it?
Well, no question about it, and obviously the just as you mentioned, the friends and peers of baseball helped my family and helped John, my son, and Roxana, the mother, helped them get through a difficult time. John and I had baseball where we could kind of put it aside to a degree. It's never forgotten and never will be forgotten, but we had to go on, and baseball helped us do that with the help of our friends and with the friends in baseball. Roxana, the mother, she had to grieve a different way. She had to write a book about Christina's life and get involved with the charity of Christina and then eventually now has gotten involved in the gun control business, and along with Gabby and her husband. So life goes on, and even though it's hard, I still tear up from time to time because I see something that reminds me of her. She was a wonderful little gal, and our family was hurt deeply.
And regardless, and so I sense that is a, you don't want to get as involved in the debate, because it is something that I would think perhaps takes away from the fact at hand that you lost your granddaughter.
Well, I don't think it's I think if the family wants to get involved in the direct family, that is, I see no problem with it. People obviously have asked me my opinion of it, and my opinion is very simple. I'm a hunter. My son, I taught my sons how to hunt and do it safely, and we've taught our grandson to hunt and do it safely. But for the life of me, I can't understand ever why somebody wants to have a 33,000 or 33 33 round magazine in a Glock or an AK-47 or anything. Those guns are meant to kill. They're meant to kill people, and that's usually what ends up doing.
When you think of you're still working with the Phillies, you still are involved in many aspects of the game and spotting talent, and that's something that you still enjoy. You still enjoy that aspect of being part of the game.
No question. No question about it. And Ruben Amaro Sr., well, first Pat Gillick, but then Ruben Amaro Sr., has allowed me to stay on. My chores are pretty easy for an old-time baseball guy. I get to go to all the home games. Don't have to travel anymore. But I also go to Reading and Allentown and Clearwater and Williamsport and some of the other Lakewood and some of the other Philly ball clubs and make the evaluation of the players and also of our staff. So I'm still involved. When the mouth that roars, it still roars from time to time. but a lot of times now, not as many people listen as they used to.
And this is a tough year for the Phillies. So is this when it roars more?
Well, it's a tough year. There's no question about that. And I'm not down on the field, so it's not my responsibility to roar. Obviously, we have our own thoughts up in the box, and I still manage the game, and I still try to get the team to, in my own mind, how to play the game right. I think our team is just inconsistent, and it's going to struggle all year, but hopefully they figure it out in time for us to get on some kind of a decent run, and we stay in the hunt.
Well, the name of the book is The Mouth That Roared, My Six Outspoken Decades in Baseball. It's published by Triumph. Dallas Green, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much, and thank you for the years of great fun in watching you and what you've done for baseball.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Dallas Green's book is The Mouth That Roared. It's published by Triumph. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.